Okay, so I've been keeping bees since, 45 years, since I was 5 years old. I've been breeding bees since working at the Bee Lab 1996, so it's been a long time. And when I talk about breeding, I'm going to use as an example what I know best, which is breeding for the varroa sensitive hygiene trait. It's a good example for selecting, but it's not a great breeding program, and I'll explain that as we go. But let me just give you some background. At the time that we got varroa mites, nobody really had succeeded in producing in European stock any form of really useful resistance. And the mood was pretty gloomy. There were quotes from, I think, Friedrich Reutner of Germany that, you know, breeding bees for resistance to varroa would be like breeding sheep resistance to wolves. That's how the outlook was. And so what we decided as scientists was just to try and find something and amplify it and produce it in a line, which is really not a good way to deliver something to the beekeeping public. Well, I thought that. I'm actually re-amending that, and actually it might be a good way because so many people are interested in developing their own locally adapted stocks. It actually might be a good way to trickle in a new trait to something that already exists. So we've promoted it as a way to get varroa resistance into bees if you want to try it. But there are issues with it, and I hope to cover that as I talk about both these talks. Now, what I hope to do in this talk, I'm going to talk about BSH in both talks. But what I really want to try and emphasize is sort of the how-to, different ways you might select. That's what this talk is, selection. Because it's kind of like beekeeping. Beekeeping is essentially simple. You find the number one lesson, the first lesson in beekeeping is you find a place to put bees that has food. You let them do what they do, and get a bee when you need to. That's beekeeping. Pretty simple.
Right.
Well, breeding is kind of the same thing. Breeding is, you've got a population of colonies or individuals. You pick the best to be your parents for the next generation. You cross them, and you check their offspring, and the cycle continues year after year after year. Pretty simple. No. The main problem you have with breeding any animal is that when you start to select for things you want, you start to automatically narrow the genetic pool of your population. And if you go too narrow, guess what happens? You inbreed. And you end up with 7 toes on 1 foot, like I do. I have. I'm from Appalachia. Hopefully no one else in here is. So what I hope to do is kind of like give you an outline of selection, how you might measure. There are no really hard, fast rules. There's some guidance here. It's some of this is seat of your pants. Once you start doing it, there's a little bit of art to breeding. It's kind of like somebody who's breeding dogs, Labrador retrievers that are good at getting ducks, actually retrieving, not for confirmation. They can look at an animal, watch it run in a field, and they're like, yeah, that's going to be a good stud. You know, there's a feeling you get, and that's the art part of breeding, and it just takes experience before you get that. Especially with bee colonies, because one of the problems we have with breeding bees, we're almost always interested in colony-level traits. How much honey did that colony produce? How well did it overwinter? But we're selecting at the queen level. Well, you're selecting at the colony level, but you're manipulating queens to keep those traits. So you're almost always measuring things at the colony level. And that's not always easy to do. But we do the best we can. So what I want to do is start off with just one type of selection you can do, and this is something Sue Covey talked about in the 80s that she used to produce her New World colony only bees. And that is, you could think of several traits you're interested in measuring in colonies, and then for each trait, you actually have a subjective scale of 1 to 5, with 5 being the best and 1 being the worst in performance for that trait. And you would score, and you would basically, the whole point about breeding, though, is you've got to do everything on a level playing field. Your colonies have to be established about the same way and about the same time and about the same location, because we all know if you set up 1 apiary here and go 3 miles down the road, you can actually have vastly different honey production in 2 apiaries. You can have 90 pounds here and 25 pounds here. And so therefore you have to do statistical weighting of yard effects if you do that. But we won't get into much of that. So, because that's a little bit over my head even. I mean, we do it all the time, but it's not something, it's really not good to do here. But I just want you to be aware that when you're going to compare colonies, you really ought to try and set them up as fair a level playing field as you can, if, especially within an eighth area. You don't want to start off one colony with three boxes of Ds and the other one starting off from a nuke, and they compare them at the end of the season for various traits like honey production. That's just not fair. It's not the same. Okay, so one thing you can do with this index, and I'm going to talk about several things, and here's an example. So here are some characteristics you might be interested in. And here are the scores. So here's a colony that through a season, you scored it, subjective scale, on these different things, and scored it this way. When you're comparing a lot of different colonies, you can do this for every colony and actually add up the scores and divide by the number of traits and get an average. The average score for all these traits in this colony is 3.8. And then what you can simply do is do this and then select those with the highest indices, because 5 is good. Closer to 5 you are, the better you are. That's one thing. And so, for example, here's colony B. Notice these two colonies actually have the same average because they differ on a couple traits. All I did was grow resistance was 4 in this one, and in colony B, spring buildup was 4. But they end up with the same average. If you were selecting just on averages, either one of these would be equal pairings. However, if you want to emphasize one trait over another, let's say the grow resistance is more important to you, you would do a weighted average. And I'll talk about that in a minute. But before you even do that, you might say to yourself, when I breed bees, let's go back to colony A, I'm not going to breed from any colony that has a defensive behavior under 4. And you could do that. You could do that first. You could say, screen all your colonies. I don't want stingy bees. Eliminate anything that's below 4. You could do that step 1. And that eliminates hissy bees. And do that every time you select. The only problem with that is you might eliminate some really good grow resistance. You might have a colony that's really high in grow resistance, but it's really stingy. So you have to decide what's important. I don't like stingy bees, so I don't mind putting a ceiling on a value and say you can't get below that. That's a way to keep a trait up high. So that's a strategy you might consider before you look at anything else. What is really important to you? What will you not tolerate? Stingingness. Maybe you want honey production that's always 50 pounds. If your colony is under 50 pounds, I'm not going to breed from it. If you put that kind of stringent selection on, you'll make progress faster with that trait that you're looking at, okay? Mm-hmm. But let's go back to this example. Let's say I decided that varroa resistance is 3 times more important than any other trait in this population. Then you can actually create your own equation where you weight that factor by 3. And then if you do the average, this colony is 4.6, the next colony is higher, 5.8. So this would be a better pairing if that's what you want to emphasize. So it's up to you. You have to decide what you like. And a lot of people have locally adapted stocks that they're developing, and there are things they like about them. And I'm one of those, you know, when I was growing up, I was a southern beekeeper that worked with a southern package producer, and we sold queens and packages to you guys. You were our market. They grew it. We had a big market in Canada, too. So I understand why southern beekeepers, for example, like Italian stocks. Very fast buildup. We can shake the heck out of them and milk them for packages and sell them to you guys. And of course, we produce some queens that have those traits, and they'll starve themselves to death in your environment, or they don't overwinter well. So I understand fully. What I've never comprehended is why southern bee breeders, let's call them, never had like a northern selection scheme where they could cater to the market. Or, you know, sort of have a research facility in the northern states to do selection there. Maybe it's too expensive, I don't know. But anyway, so I fully understand why there might be a desire to say, hey, I'm tired of buying southern bees. Their characteristics that they have for their production don't fit our beekeeping style and our climate and everything we need. So I fully understand why you might want to select bees for your own home use and from your local regions. And there's a lot of interest around the world in that. So now I'm going to actually talk about what we did with the VSA trait briefly. And the reason I'm doing this is I want to talk about when you decide to select for something, what you decide to measure. And in particular, what I want to emphasize is growth. So when we began, we just said, hey, we don't know what mechanisms of resistance are out there. We knew that Apis serrana were good groomers. Apis serrana is the native host for this mite. We knew that they were good groomers. We knew that they probably, they isolated the mites in the drone brood, and they probably were good at hygiene, and there's a couple other things that do well. We didn't know what would be in European bee populations. So we just simply said, these are the things you need. This is a very important point. It needs to be heritable. So for example, if you set up a bunch of colonies, and they do really well, and they don't have mites at the end of the season, how do you know it's a heritable trait of bees? The first season, you don't. You have to basically select the parents, and after a few years of experience of taking those parents, producing offspring, again getting the best, if you start to see progress, the trait improving, then you got a pretty good idea it's heritable. But for example, if I was going to select mite resistance and all I did was measure the right population of a group of colonies at the end of the season, if I didn't know whether they had mites or not at the beginning, that's useless. You need to know that they were challenged. That's the other thing. If you live in an isolated area and you've got 50 colonies in the backyard that never had a single varroa mite, and at the end of the year you measure, hey, there's no mites in these colonies, they may not be resistant. They just may never been challenged. It's hard to believe that these days because we're very good about sharing our food, beekeepers are. But it is a point to keep in mind. You can actually have, and I'll touch on this in the next talk, situations where if you really don't know that you started with mites, you really can't say you have mite resistance. You need to challenge. And we can skip this. This is just, when we were measuring mite populations, what we did was set up a short-term experiment. So we're about 16 weeks long. And in that short-term kind of test, it's still short-term, the growth of varroa mites in the early years followed an exponential curve. Now, if you go over longer terms, it's actually a logistic growth curve that goes up and down. But in the early experiments, we would set up colonies that start off with a known population, 100 mites, and at the end, the average, this was actually the average in like 1998, I think, 3,000 mites after 16 weeks. That's a lot of mites. And the colonies were getting pretty sick within another month. And, of course, at about the same time, they were developing economic thresholds, and they were saying that, basically, if you start to get into the 6,000 mite range in a colony, the bees are going to start having apparent sickness or whatever. So we wanted to select colonies. We simply set up a breeding population of colonies, and we looked at their growth rate. We could actually calculate the slope of this line with that equation that I blew through. But it's not important, the actual equation. What's important is, and I'm going to show you the scientific way we did this. You would never do what we did. But the important thing is we started off with equal colonies. They had equal populations of bees, equal populations of mites. You're not going to do it this way. What you're going to do is balance colonies out in your apiary when you start a selection program. You're going to try and start them off the same size, and you'll do it by splitting, moving brood and honey around and that kind of thing. What we did was collect 90 pounds of bees in boxes and subdivide them into cages that were weighing and pre-weighing, and we can figure out when we combine cages exactly the weight of the bees and the exact number of mites to start off in a unit. And then we run that experiment for 16 weeks. So the main thing was we had a heterogeneous mixture of bees because we collected them from many colonies, but everybody got the same mixture. The only thing different between these colonies were the queens that headed them. And the first test, we just plot 40 to 50 queens from all around the country at random. We didn't care what they were. Just stuck them in there. We wanted variation, and we just hoped we saw something. And sure enough, John Harwell and Roger Hoopengarner ran the first experiment. And then I came on the next year and helped from then on. And sure enough, they found, I think that first year, maybe a handful of queens that had lower mite populations than the rest. They used those as queen mothers and drone mothers the next year. John instrumentally inseminated and crossed them in different patterns, put them all back out, requeened all the colonies, and started the selection program again. And when you start these experiments off, after 16 weeks, you're lucky if they fill up a deep, sometimes it was a deep and a half, depending on the year. And you would then measure the mite populations at the end of the test, with alcohol wash the adult bees, and then we would measure it in the brood as well. and we would basically estimate the total mite load in our colonies. And what we found was we had colonies that after, we definitely saw really vast improvement after 3 years of doing this. And we became very confident that we had some heritable trait in bees that was causing the mite populations to stay low. There are different ways you can do this. You can control the birth rate, lower the birth rate of the mites, or you can increase the death rate of the mites. And there were different things that could do this. So the question has been, if you started this, if you took Illinois bees and did the same thing we did, would you produce BSH bees? I would say probably. We think that trait is kind of universal. It's a type of hygiene. When I can talk to you about it later, it's a type of hygiene that probably is everywhere in bees. But there are other mechanisms of resistance, and it's quite likely if you repeated the same experiment with a totally different population of bees, you'd get different traits. You'd probably get a combination of traits that control the growth of mite populations. So what I'm trying to say is even if you did the exact same thing we did, you may not get the same trait. You might get different traits, which is actually a good thing, because the more traits you have, the more arsenal you can throw at the bite when you combine stocks. So that's a good thing. So we've always had this question. We finally answered it last year. And that is Marla Spivak created the Minnesota Hygienic Line based on its response to freeze-kill brood. They would kill freeze-kill brood. How fast could they remove that? And if they bred for bees that removed dead pupae very quickly, these bees are resistant to American fowl brood, chalk brood, other diseases that can be controlled by hygiene. And they had some resistance to varroa. And here's her test. The basic idea is it takes these cylinders of liquid nitrogen and freezes a circle of, oh, it's anywhere from 160 to 200 cells. Gives them to bees for 24 hours. Hygienic ones completely remove the dead pupae. Non-hygienic ones are variable. They remove some of them maybe, but not all of them. And the actual test, this is actually Marla, one of Marla's teams with the cylinders, and you can see the result. You can see not every cell in this case. This is fairly hygienic, but not every cell is completely removed. And that's how she would select this trait in this stock of bees. And she reported in a couple of experiments, this was the thing that interested us. Sometimes they had lower varroa mites than regular bees. Commercial controls from California, for example. And what that suggests is that general hygiene, hygienic mechanism may be a way to get varroa. Well, she did that first, and then we basically created our bees, and I'll just skip to the punch. It took us several years, but we basically found out that our bees resist varroa mites by smelling the mite families in the cell and removing the pupa. And I'll show you that in the next talk, a little more detail. So the question has been, once we found that out, the question has been, how are these two traits related? How does Marla's trait for Minnesota Hygienic relate to the VSH trait? And the question has always been, if you select for Marla's trait, can you produce the same varroa resistance that we have in the VSH bees? That's what breeders were asking us. And a lot of people were trying to do this to get the varroa resistance at the level that we have at the bee battery bee lab. So we did the experiment ourselves. Now, I want to give Marla a lot of credit because she was smart enough to get out of the breeding game. She's like, anybody who's bred bees, it's a multi-year commitment. And each year, see, we can only keep selected stock in the form of living queens. We don't have a way to freeze semen very reliably. They're working on it, trying to improve it. Steve Shepard and some others, including Sue. But we still don't really have a reliable way of freezing semen like they can with bull semen. Or embryos, that would be nice too, if we could freeze honeybee embryos. So the only way we can reliably keep stock alive through the winter is in a living queen, which means a lot of propagation, a lot of maintenance of colonies with queens in it. And that's a lot of work. I think you spend most of your time as a breeder doing beekeeping, and maybe 5% of your time actually doing selection, mating, and whatever. The rest is just trying to keep them alive and for the next season. So she got smart and says, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to teach the queen breeders how to do it themselves. She tried that. And when that didn't work so well, it worked for some, she said, okay, I'm going to create a tech transfer team that they can hire to come make the measurements for them, which is very clever. So, and the breeders are willing to pay for it. And this young tech transfer team, I think she has more than one team now, maybe two or three now. Teams now go out to the breeders and do measurements of various things, including hygiene, and allow the breeders to help them choose their breeders in California or elsewhere. And I've actually seen, when they started doing this, I was buying California queen stocks used in my experiments, and I started noticing the improvement in hygiene, in general hygiene with them. I saw what was happening, and it was working pretty well. Now, I've already told you, I skipped to the chase about our bees, grow-assisted hygiene, and this is just the way I measure it. So these bees are able to smell my infested pupae and remove them from combs. And so one way you can measure it is this. Here's some BSA bees. Let me explain some things going on here in this diagram. This is a frame of cat brood in this stage, the pre-pupa stage. And what we did was we opened 200 cells of that kind of brood. Actually, we used two combs. I'm showing one comb. When we sample colleges, we choose two cat brood combs from their nest, and we opened 200 cells of brood and measured the mite load in those combs. And when it's written as 19%, what that means is there were 19 mites per 100 cells we examined in that comb. That's a lot of mites in this comb. And we got these mites from an apiary of colonies that we simply had around for growing mites. That was their job. We knew susceptible lines. We grow mites for research. And what we found is if I stick that comb into a VSH colony for a week and take it out a week later, the mite load was reduced by more than half, two-thirds in a week. They actually removed. So if we went back through and we would do this, open another 200 cells, we found the mite population greatly reduced. And then we realized it was hygiene probably going on. Just to show you controls, sometimes there was a little change, most of the time not. That was one of the first time we ever did it, to show that it was hygiene. Then we did, I'm going to just show you some of the other things. I think that, no, I don't, I do that in the next talk. I'll show you some of the other few things we did to prove it was hygiene. So now back to this experiment. The question is, if you highly select using monospivic freeze-kill brood technique, will you produce BSHBs? It's the basic question. So we did an experiment, and this I lived to write in the paper, but we had commercial Italian controls, not selected, Minnesota hygienic, we're calling it freeze-kill brood hygienic, outcross BSH and purebred BSHBs. And all I'm going to show you from this diagram is we set these colonies up equally with equal mites and stuff at the beginning of the season. And then look at the mite infestation after almost a year. I think this was 9 months. This is 26 infested cells per 100 brood cells. That's really high. Colonies were sick. Look at the freeze-kill brood, just a little bit below, 20%. That's also very high. The F1 VSH was 13%. That's above economic threshold, but still a lot lower. And then the pure VSH are very low. But that's not what I wanted to focus on. We actually measured their freeze-kill brood behavior in all four stocks. We found no difference. The commercial controls were being improved by her tech transfer team, and they were just as good as those being sold as Minnesota Hygienic. And then the two VSHs were, there was no difference in their removal of dead pupa that were killed by liquid action. No difference at all. So that suggests that the freeze-kill brood hygienic abilities of VSH bees and Minnesota hygienic bees are the same. And even commercial controls now are getting up there. We actually looked at them. Normally Marlon runs her test for 24 hours. We ran it through 65 hours. It was ridiculous. But anyway, the basic thing is there's no difference there. But drum roll. When we measure the varroa removal by sticking that infected comb in for a week and taking it out, look at the difference. The freeze-kill Minnesota hygienic controls were very poor at removing varroa mites. The other two, which is what they were selected for, are pretty good at it. So what this tells you is, those two forms of hygiene are not the same. You're not going to get, if you select for this, you're not going to get there, most likely.
So they can contain it within their established hives, but when you bring in an excessive source from outside and give it to them, they're not going to clean it up.
Right. Apparently so. That's what this experiment shows. So we sort of say that if you select for Minnesota Hygienic freeze-kill brood response, you may not get a very big grower removal. You're going to get some.
I mean, this wasn't statistically, look at the variation, a lot of variation here. But this wasn't statistically different, but certainly there is an improvement, a trend of improvement. But it's not on the order of what we selected for the bat and the bee lab with the BSA plants. The removals are really high.
Okay. The F1 and the pure, fairly close. Those were outcrossed. I mean, those were naturally made.
Right.
These were. And so, can I assume that there was a fair amount of BSH in the?
That's actually a very good point. We probably produced these ourselves at the Baton Rouge Bee Lab. We've got drone sources all around, so there's no way we can't guarantee that these are probably better than 50%. You're right. These are not strictly F1s. We don't know what percentage of BSH drones are actually in them because we have so many around there. Because we produce these at the lab. You're right. We tried to get them isolated, but you just don't know. Because they can fly. Drones can fly 3 to 5 miles to me. So you're right. This is probably artificially inflated because of where we made them. If we made them here, maybe this would be down some.
So the pure BSH would be instrumental in some of
these
products.
Right.
What happens to hive production?
Well, that's a good point we'll get to, and that's one thing. That's the problem when you focus on a trait. We didn't care about honey production. This is just another measurement of hygiene. I won't explain it now, but I'll go ahead and give you a little bit of explanation. It turns out when hygienic bees smell something, a pupa that's infected, they take the cap off. They punch a hole in it, and then sometimes they recap it without doing anything. It's like there are multiple bees doing these characteristics. Some sense something and uncap it, and then another bee wanders around, says, who's not as sensitive to the varroa inside, says, hey, that's a pupa, that's supposed to be capped, and they'll recap it. So there's continual tug of war between hygienic bees who think, hey, we need to clean this out, and hive bees that say, hey, that should be capped, and you actually get these higher rates of recapped cells because of this tug of war that goes on. And interestingly, the freeze-kill brood hygiene actually matches in that behavior. So what we think is they're actually smelling varroa and uncapping it. They're recapping it. They're just not removing it. And so that may be a clue to the genetic differences between the two, because they're both hygiene. They're detecting it, uncapping and looking, but they're not removing it. And these guys are removing it, as you saw in the first next slide. So we think there's just subtle, it's probably a subtle one or two gene difference that's been enhanced in these, that makes it different from Minnesota hygienic. Anyway, we'll already summarize that. So I just want to show you that example, and then I want to talk about selecting. What I want to do is talk specifically about this trait, and then we'll just open it up for, and then I'll talk a little bit about propagation. The reason I did that is because there are a lot of people who want to select for this trait in their own bees. And you may nail it on the head. The whole discussion here is selecting one trait, not focusing on honey production and defense behavior, overwintering, all that. It's just focusing on this. John Harbaugh is the one with Roger Hubergar that found this, and he retired from Baton Rouge in 05. Didn't have any bees. It took him a year to buy bees. He had a pioneer swarm insemination device. But he's been breeding for this trait ever since. And the reason I want to give this as an example is he helped with all these intricate measurements that we do at the bee lab that no one else in their right mind would ever do. You don't have the labor or the time to do that. And he's very pragmatic, but he's still very interested in this trait. So he decided, I'm going to basically create a model system on how you can select for this by hedging your bets and buying stock that's already got the trait. And so that's what he did. And he only runs 50 colonies of bees. In an apiary not far from his home. So here's his goal. And he's producing brood queens that can be bought. HarboBeeCompany.com if you're interested. And so he said, look, I helped Tom and Suki Glenn produce lines that are sold to beekeepers. I'm just going to turn right around now that I'm retired, and I'm going to buy breeders from Tom Glenn. So that's what he did. He bought the stock that he helped develop. So he bought some breeders the first year. And then what he likes to do is, because he can inseminate, and let me just throw a sheet in, he said, okay, what I'm going to do is every year, this is a very small scale. Bee breeders would never have a laugh, but I'm not laughing because he's been successful. 25 queens. I'm going to do single drone inseminations among my population and select 25 queens to be my breeding population. And from those 25, the best three or four become queen mothers, and the rest are drone sources. Unless they're really bad. And then, so he does the selection, he uses the best three or four as queen mothers, and then he does multiple mating for selling to you. But what he has to do is he has to be very severe on these things. One of the best ways, if you hear nothing else today, in your selection of your locally adapted stock or whatever, keep an eye on your brood quality. How solid is that brood pattern? And don't let it ever get below 85% solid. Because that's the best counter to inbreeding. It's one of the, I'll talk about inbreeding in a minute. But if you make sure your brood pattern stays really good all year round, not just once, measure it multiple times in each queen through the year. Because it's possible for a queen to have a good brood pattern early and then it falters later. So you want to make sure it's consistent and good, and it's the best way to offset inbreeding, one of the best ways. And actually, the tendency to supersede, obviously workers often realize that something's wrong with their queen before you do. So if he has any of those issues happening, those queens are eliminated from the breeding pool. But really focus on brood quality. And of course, he's not very picky. He's not trying to make 400 pounds of honey, so he's not really even focused on honey production. He makes all the honey he wants. He doesn't like the stinging bees. And anything obvious, it's very obvious to see queens that are susceptible to chalk brood or this new snotty brood, which no one really knows what's going on with that. If those occur, they get eliminated. Not regular chalk brood, a persistent chalk brood infection into the summer is what you want to eliminate. Just about every colony can have chalk brood in early spring when foraging really cranks up. But if it persists, it goes into the year, you don't want to breed from that. So you just severe culling for that. And then this is the science. Now when he was at the lab, we would actually measure, we call these bees suppressed mite reproduction bees early because this is where we measured it first. In a normal population of mice, 3/4 of the mice are able to normally lay eggs. And one of the first characteristics we notice in these mice is only 1/3 or less do in these selected bees. And that's where we got off to calling them SMR bees. John likes measuring this. I don't. I like measuring the results of hygiene that I showed you earlier using infected comb going into colony for a week. John likes to measure this. The reason I don't like to measure this is if you've got a highly resistant colony and you go to find mites, you don't find that many. You find less than 5 mites per 100 cells. And so, and to get a decent pie chart, the statisticians always tell us you need 30 mites. So these pie charts were roughly 300 mites, and we looked through literally 50,000 cells to get 300 mites to make these pie charts. That's incredible work. So I said, John, you like measuring that. How are you doing it now? He's not doing it the way we did to make these pie charts. Here's what he does. It's kind of at the bottom here. These are the important points. I talked to the other day. I said, okay, what do you think are the most important things? I've already told you this. They must have mites. If you're going to select from bees that are mite resistant, make sure they have mites at the start. He likes to examine 100 cap brood cells from each colony. That's probably beyond what many of you would want to do, but that's still less than what we do at the bee lab. And then he would actually identify the reproductive status of each mite he encountered. Now, if you only look at 100 cells and these colonies are really resistant, you're only going to get a few mites. Statisticians will laugh about publication. And he tells me sometimes he only gets one mite. But because he knew he started with a strong trait, he bought it, he doesn't care. I think in the worst case situation, he would get 5 mites he encountered in 100 cells. And he would make these decisions on whether to use that queen or not based on low numbers. So if he found only one mite without eggs, one mite out of 100, he's saying, that's still got a lot of resistance. Statisticians in science would never let him publish that. But guess what? It's working. It's working for him. I bought 3 of his breeders at $250 a piece this year, and I just wanted to test him because he's been doing that for 5 years, and I've been doing something else, and I wondered how different we are now. And his were just as good as mine on mite removal. So we're just selecting a different way. Yes, sir.
When you're talking about uncapping 100 cells, does it matter whether it's worker or drone?
Oh, it needs to be worker. Because most of our work was done with worker brood. Certainly, we don't have enough data to talk about non-reproduction in drones. Most of our, because we felt like most of the harm caused by varroa is actually in the worker brood. It's what it does, the viral disease it does to the worker population that ultimately kills the colony. So we focused all our effort on worker brood. That's a good question. So anyway, that's just an example of, again, he's focused on one trait, but he's trying to find a quicker way of selecting this trait than what we used to do in the lab. It's still not great. How many of you are going to look at 100 cap brood cells per queen? How many of you have the microscope set up for doing that? You could do it. Believe me, it's not that hard. If I showed you, you'd be like, oh, that's easy. Well, it's not easy. It takes a while. You get faster. This is the bottom line. He doesn't treat his 50 colonies, and he's got his rural mice under control using his breeding method. And that's what counts. It works for him. And he's selling to breeders, and it's working for other people. This is something I think is important when you think about low adaptive stock. So this is getting up. This is sort of a more general. We're backing up to a more general philosophy now about breeding. You don't have to let colonies die when you're breeding. A lot of people think you have to let them die and only use the survivors. Well, no. You're losing production. What you do is you monitor your mite populations and you say, well, that colony will die if I don't intervene, but I'm going to intervene because I want the honey production. I want to get pollination service from that colony. I'm just not going to breed from it. So here's what I like to think about. You want, in any population, your bees, my bees, whatever, you want to select the top 10%, let's say, as your queen mothers and your drone mothers. That's a given. Breed from the best of whatever your measure. Colonies with the highest threshold and over the treatment threshold, which for most people is 5% of mites and adult bees anymore. People don't like the 10% number. Don't breed from them. So if you run a set of colonies and you get colonies that get up way above in mite numbers, don't breed from them. Don't let them produce queens or drones. But save them. Intervene. Do what you normally do to save the colony for honey production or whatever. There's no sense letting it die. Get some value out of it. Just don't breed from it. Don't let it make drones. Don't raise queens. And this is what's really important. It turns out intermediate colonies, those are kind of in the middle, may have some resistant genes. They're just not expressed very high, and they're there. And if you tweaked it by amplifying and selecting from it, you might improve it. And if you just got rid of them, these are colonies that kind of grew mite populations that make you uncomfortable. They're getting close to your economic threshold. You don't like it, but it's still lower than threshold, is what I would say, after a year. There may not be anything to it. It may just be they're lucky. But there may be some genes there at a low frequency that give them some resistance. And if you just got rid of them by treating them like you did this group, you would lose those genes. Whereas if you include them in drone sources, you might be able to amplify those genes to the next generation and so forth. So you sort of have three groups of colonies you can think about. Treat the sickest and don't breed from them. No queens or drones. Only those with the lowest mite populations, your top 10%, will be your queen mothers, let's say. And those with intermediate, you preserve them, you treat them, and you allow the drone production. And then over time, you may get multiple mechanisms of resistance. That's what this group is important for. When you first encounter them, because this is the story of the VSH trait, we encountered colonies that kind of looked shaky. They were like lower than the average, but still wasn't great the first year or so. But after amplifying it, it became great. So preserving colonies that might not be the most resistant, but are certainly better than these, and using their drones in your breeding, may get you other mechanisms of resistance. And what we really want in bees are more than one mechanism of resistance to this test. Again, I'm focusing on one trait. And the whole reason we're doing this, you guys all know about, is the chemicals and combs. We want people to use less of these chemicals, go more organic if you can. You've probably seen these reports. We try and talk about IPM, ways to try and prevent populations from getting up here. And one of the basic things you can do is produce a stock of bees
that's more resistant than others in medium. That's a great cultural practice. And that's the idea behind locally adapted stock. To help keep your mite populations from getting out of hand. How much time? How are we doing? I haven't looked at a clock. Okay, good. So now I'm going to go a step back now and say, okay, once you've decided on selecting things, you should be shot for wanting to be a bee breeder in the first place. You're not well. It is a commitment. It really is. It's not going to happen overnight. For example, if you want to improve honey production, your average honey production is 85 pounds per colony. You're not going to 400 pounds next year after your first selection. If you want to get 400 pounds, it's probably going to take some management changes as well as some selection of stock. But you can get there. It may take 15 years. I mean, that's the kind of commitment that we'll be breeding. So now I'm going to get to the nuts and bolts. Stu's right. This is not a talk about how to graft and things like that, but I do want to point out some things about mating. Bees normally mate in the air, and they're normally multiply mated. Colonies of bees do best when they're multiply mated to unrelated drones. Okay, each queen typically mates with 20 to 25 drones. And it's a genetically diverse set of drones. The colony has many, many traits to offset all kinds of things that are thrown at it by nature and you. Of course, I've already told you, when you start selecting and you want to breed selected parents, you got to control the mating. How are you going to do that in central Illinois? Well, one way we did it in Louisiana is we had barrier islands. And I hated going there. It's brutal out here. There's no fresh water. Mosquitoes are terrible. The heat beating down on the colonies. But we can take down the queen sources and the drone sources. There's no other bees on these islands because there's 25 miles of salt marsh barrier. There's no way honeybees can live in this habitat. We brought down all the drones and all the queens. And whatever the seagulls didn't eat, they were the babies we wanted. Okay? How many people have an island in the lake? You? Probably some of you in Chicago. So this is not an option for most people. This is, and this does work. Larry Connor, this is the tried and true. And this is, in fact, what I'm going to do in Starkville. And the idea is, you may not be able to totally control your mating, but you can certainly have a high impact on what your queens mate with. So you establish a mating yard, and you basically saturate within a mile of it, like on the four corners of a box if you want. Other apiaries are going to be your drone sources. And both sets of queens are selected. Your drone sources are in your top colonies, and your queen sources are in your top colonies every year. And you can get pretty good control. Now, Larry didn't do this experiment, but the Baton Rouge Bee Lab did this. They said, well, this technique worked with Africanized bees in an Africanized bee environment. So they took this technique to Venezuela, and they took quarter-inch Italian bees, like you get from C.F. Conan or Wooten. You know, they had the quarter-inch trait. And they said, let's produce quarter-inch versions and make them in a highly Africanized area where we saturate the corners, the drone corners, with only quarter-producing drones. And then the way you can tell mating frequency is simple. If a lot of Africanized bees mate with them, you get a lot of non-quarter-inch workers. If they mate mostly with quarter-inch drones, they'll get mostly quarter-inch workers. So they did the matings of, I forgot how many hundreds of versions they mated, and they had 95% mating control. What that means is 95 workers out of 100 had quarter-inch traits, which means they were mating mostly with the drones we put out there. Even though there's a sea of Africanized bees all around them, the technique worked in Venezuela. That's a strong testimonial that if you can control drones or at least saturate areas close to your mating yard, you can have pretty good control. It's not absolute, but you can have pretty good control of your mating. And that's a strategy you're going to have to use if you're going to produce your own locally adapted stock. So you need to be aware of who your neighbors are. You don't want your husky queens mating with that, you know, that low-life drone down the road. You want it to be the right drone. So you may have to negotiate. I mean, if you've got beekeepers near you, either work together where the drones, your buddy's producing 2 miles down the road, are drones you want to mate with your queen. So it may require you requeening his bees every year for him, if he's willing to cooperate with you like that. But these are things you need to think about.
if you really want to control a stock, you need to control its mating. And you can do it, but you may need help, especially if you've got other beekeepers around you. You're lucky if you live in the middle of nowhere and you have total control. And there are a lot of people up in the Canadian provinces, the Peace River. There's nothing out there that can they can control matings very easily in places like that. Yes, sir.
Couldn't you, it's kind of a varroa control and breeding program, you can take a varroa comb from one hive and stick it in another at a distance away of your breeding stock and give it to somebody else rather than requeening his hives.
I guess the only thing there is you got to know that it actually, the requeening was actually successful. It actually raised. I mean, what would be better is if you have a fully mated queen of a stock where you know it's controlled, it's the drones in. Both the drones that mated with and the queen you produced are what you want to mate your next round of queens with. It's better to give them that queen.
Yes, well.
Yeah. Or at least a queen that's a daughter of one of those because she'll produce drones that you want. But yeah, anything you can do to up your odds of getting the genes you want, your stock mated, is a good idea.
Or you could remove a lot of his drones and put your own in his boxes.
Yes, you can. Yeah. Just physically do it. Yeah.
And you're actually taking varroa mites and giving them to him anyway.
Look, don't raise any drones this year. Remove all your drone brood. And let me give you drones.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can certainly do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. In fact, you know, Larry, and actually Larry likes putting multiple drone sources in one colony anyway to really get the odds up. So that's a lot of work, but you can certainly do that. And one caution. Well, I haven't really said this, but if you're going to breed, you got to control varroa. And you've got to control it before you're actually raising your queens and drones. Because if varroa gets out of hand while you're raising queens and drones, the viruses will affect the quality of what you produce. And then if you have to put chemical treatments on, those chemicals will affect the quality of what you produce. So it's a mess. You really have to control your varroa in your mating yard long before you're at this point.
Well, you could go through a program of constantly breaking the mite cycle every time.
But the problem with that is, well, yeah, if, independent of your selection, because you need to know, if you're really going to select for resistance, you need to select for resistance.
I mean, if nothing else, take your queen out, bank her, and then come back, put her back in a month later, and start again.
It's hard.
Well, I just...
Yeah, I mean, it works. I mean, there are a lot of people that do brood breaks in Europe just to control varroa. It'd be nice if you didn't have to.
Right.
Just let the bees do have some mechanism of resistance.
But if you're going to look for her, then there she is, and take her away. Yeah, I mean.
And of course, the absolute control of mating is instrumental insemination. There's no doubt. You can raise the drones. You can immerse them when they're young. You can mark them. Know what queen they came from. Know everything about them. Same with the queens. Queens are tagged as virgins. And you control the mating. You can control the number of drones, the mixture. And you know, if you do this well, this is one thing I did emphasize, as a breeder, you're going to keep records. I've got 17 years of records on my lines. I know all the way back to when we started, how they're related. And it's amazing when you lose track how quickly you inbreed. It's very difficult. Yes, sir.
Back to what you were talking about before, about living in the drones and so on and so forth, your neighbor, what he had. What about the wild population of bees?
That's
no control.
No, you have
some of them might be very viable to live.
Well, that's what that's what I was trying to describe when I talk about the Baton Rouge Bee Lab meeting Cordovan in Venezuela. That's an intense feral Africanized population, much more intense than you're probably seeing here, especially post varroa. Varroa wiped out a lot of ferals. But at the time they did this experiment in Venezuela, there was a huge feral population all around of Africanized bees, and yet they got 95% mating control using this technique. That's a pretty good, strong testament that even with a heavy feral population out there, in this case it was Africanized bees, they still had 95% mating control. So even with feral bees, if you can do this, you're probably going to have pretty good control. And the only way you're going to know is if you know your stock. And you start to see it slipping on something, then you know you're losing your control. I know it's kind of, so you need experience with your own.
So in a nutshell, this is primarily a saturation technique.
Yep, that is.
Okay.
And that's probably the best technique for a situation you guys are in. Unless you're going to do instrumental insemination, but that has its downfalls too, because to produce
quality laying queens with instrumental insemination, you really got to be good at the technique. It takes practice. And you have issues of queen performance related to your performance as an inseminator that are totally independent of genetics, but they get confounded. If the queen only lives 9 months, how are you going to select from that? Mm-hmm. So you need to be good at making AI queens if you're going to use it.
Yeah, you've interjected another variable that's not part of nature.
Exactly. But people who are good at this, Jacoby, Garrett Dodds, myself, Don Harbo, we can produce queens that, you mentioned a queen that was from, someone mentioned one from Suki et al. Was that an AI queen? This lived 3 years now?
With all the sensitive height.
Was it instantly inseminated?
He was inseminated.
See, John Harbo, I was really impressed. When John retired from the lab, he left me with some inseminated queens. And I had one of his queens go 4 years, an instantly inseminated queen. Mm-hmm. So that's a guy who has good skills. When I first started, I couldn't get queens to live my first 1 year, instantly inseminated queens. And that's my fault. So it takes time to get that skill. But if you are good at this, this is the best way to control mating. We've already gone over all this. What I'm trying to get to, though, is how do you measure different traits? You can do all kinds of things. You can weigh the honey produced. You can just count the boxes of honey produced. I had 3 deets. I had 2 deets. Just some measurement. Qualify. It's hard to measure this. Sometimes it's just better to say, you know, I'm going to visit these colonies 7 or 8 times a year. Every time I visit, I'm going to score their defense behavior. If I get no stings and they're real pleasant and they're not very runny, they're going to get 5. If I get 5-10 stings, they're going to get a 2. And they're running and they're dropping off the frames, they're going to get a 1, you know? And you do it all year, and what you'll find is colonies vary. You know, if a skunk has been picking on a colony all night and you come that day, you're going to have some mean bees. They've been picked on for a week by skunks or whatever. You don't know that. You're just like, man. But you come back 2 months later, the skunk's gone to another yard or something, and you're like, these bees are really pleasant. Only one time in the year do they have an odd record. Take the average as the real indicator of the defense behavior. But again, I think the most important thing, especially if you're going to start producing locally adapted stock where you're controlling drone saturation, watch your brood quality. Don't let that cat brood pattern slip below 15 cells missing out of 100. Best to be better than that, but that's the minimal I would let it slip. And that's a good way to control inbreed. Because if you accidentally do inbreed, you're going to get 50% brood viability, and that'll be obvious. You're like, don't breed from that. That's a great way to. So I'm just going to talk about real quickly different things you can do. You can do what we did with the BSH line. This is not good news. Bees inbreed a lot faster than other animals for various reasons. But if you really want to enhance the trait quickly, you can deliberately inbreed and then cull. That's kind of what we did with the BSH trait. And then what you do to sell that, you're not going to sell the purebred BSH trait to you because it has some defects, because by inbreeding and focusing on one trait, we've actually eliminated some beneficial traits. So what you do is you mate it with something else that has a lot of things, and we call that outcrossing or inbred line breeding, hybrid breeding. And that's what the BH program is. The best BSH production queens for you to use in your colonies is daughters of a purebred queen mated to anything else. They're highly variable, but on average they have much better resistance than commercial stock. And so here's just to show you what's happening. So you've got a pure BSH queen. You mate her to 100% unrelated drones that don't have the trait. You produce workers or queens that have half the trait on average. That means they have half the resistance of the parent population. And we did a lot of experiments to show that it was adequate. The resistance was adequate and better than controls. However, it doesn't work in all situations. We use that stock in Hawaii. And their season is so long, they're producing drones 9 months a year, and you know drones grow mites faster than worker brood. That stock cannot control the mites in Hawaii. An outcross BSH couldn't do it. The conditions there for mite growth are just too severe. It wasn't enough. So even though it works well in the mainland where we have discrete periods of drone production in the spring and again in the fall, you tweak it tweak it a little bit and it doesn't have the control. So, but really what I want to get to is you got to watch for inbreeding. And I just want to give you that inbreeding. You've probably all seen this, why inbreeding occurs. And we tend to focus on the sex determination to be because it's the easiest thing to see when you inbreed. And it turns out sex is determined in us by chromosomes. If you have two X chromosomes, you're female, and each chromosome has hundreds, thousands of genes. And if you're XY, you're a male. If the Y chromosome has genes on there, the females don't, it can cause you to become male as you develop. In these, it's not a chromosome, it's a single gene that determines sex. And I'm going to explain that to show you how inbreeding is bad. This gene has different forms that are called alleles. This is typical of any genetics. There are multiple forms of genes. There's the big B that causes brown eyes, the little B causes blue eyes. You know, you've seen that in the Mendelian lecture. For the sex alleles in bees, there's probably more than 20 of these. I don't know the estimate anymore. They actually can molecularly determine these now. They've actually identified them and give them names. But, yeah. But here's how sex works in bees. So I'm using this symbol for queen, that symbol for worker, that symbol, of course, for drone. Drones don't have a father. They're only made from their mother's tissue. They're haploid. It means they have one set of chromosomes. That means they only have one sex allele. So when you look at this drone, we're just saying we know his sex allele is C for this diagram. His sex allele is C. Queens are diploid, means they have two sets of chromosomes. That means they have two sex alleles. And to be female in the bee world, your sex alleles need to be different. Just different. A, D, A, Z, whatever. So here's an existing queen. You made her to this one drone. She can produce workers, two types. Each worker gets one of her sex alleles. This worker got sex allele A from the queen. This worker or this queen, it could be worker or queen, got the D sex allele from the queen mother. But there's only one sex allele from their father that they share, and that's C. But the key point is, to be female in the bee world, your sex alleles have to be different. That's just the code in the bee insect world, or at least in the bee world, that during your genetic programming from the egg, if you have two different sex alleles, you're going to be female, worker or queen. And as I've said, drones only come from their mother. So this queen, again, the same queen, she has two sex alleles. That means she can actually make two different kinds of drones. One that has sex allele A, one that has sex allele B, and if there's nothing, usually they're made in roughly 50-50 ratios. So you can see the drone is only made from maternal tissue. He's called hemizygous because he only has one copy of the sex allele because he's haploid. That's typical male in the bee world. So if you're haploid and you have one sex allele, you're going to be programmed to be a male. What happens in inbreeding is we accidentally get drones that are actually related to queens. And they start to share alleles, including the sex allele. We accidentally got a drone who may be a brother to that queen, accidentally in the population. And if I let them mate, again, the queen mother can give sex allele A to this B, sex allele D to this B. They all get the same sex allele from the father. Now, in the bee world, no one knew these bees actually existed for a long time. But they do. These are males. It turns out in the bee world, if you have two sets of chromosomes and you have the same sex allele, you are a male drone. You are a drone.
They don't pull them out?
They do. That's why we didn't know they really existed. And that's why you get shotgun brood. What happens is the workers say, oh, man, that's not a normal drone. And they eliminate it. They chew out the egg or larva, and remove it from the nest. So what happens is, if this is happening, what's going to happen in this case? What percentage of the overall brood that queen lays is going to be removed? Half her brood will be removed. And you get a formal brood pattern we call shotgun brood because this beast is eliminated. The cool story about this is Wojcie, a Polish queen breeder researcher, proved that these things actually existed by hand feeding them. He took them out of the nest, and he hand-fed them to raise them to adult drones, and then he actually did the worst thing. He took these and didn't send any queens with him. But anyway, he proved that they can live. But it's just that the workers recognize, hey, this is not normal, and they throw them out the nest. So that's what can happen in inbreeding. But the point I'm trying to make here is you're narrowing your breeding pool, and you're reducing the sex of those in your population, which increases the chance you'll produce that scenario we just looked at. We tend to focus on the sex alleles, but basically, anytime you inbreed animals, you're going to result in amplifying not just this. Let's look at this, what it looks like. So here's the kind of brood you're getting. You know, there's some misses here, but this is a decent brood pattern. That's not. And that can be the result of inbreeding. Now, other things can cause this too, but we'll just stick with inbreeding here. Yes.
But wouldn't it be more of a 1 in 20? Because, I mean, if she's going out and she's made 20.
That was an artificial case where we inserted it with one drone.
Oh,
you're right. All right. You're right. That's why you need to keep an eye on it, because it starts off like this. You start getting misses.
Yeah.
And the next generation, you know, pretty soon, it takes a few generations, you end up like this if you're not watching the brood pattern. Yes, sir.
Is there anything that could test to make sure that this is what's the problem and it's not about something else?
Yes. The best way to check for inbreeding is this pattern can be caused from hygiene, believe it or not, excessive hygiene, okay, in older people. So the best way to check for inbreeding is to have a queen lay eggs on a new comb, and more or less one side is all egg, let's say, and you watch that particular comb. And when the larva, when those eggs hatch, so you let her lay eggs, so you can have a cell builder in this sort of situation, either the queen's between splitters where you drop the comb in. I don't know if you've seen that style of queen room. You can do that and know when you put the comb in. You're going to know when those eggs hatch. And on the fourth day, they should be feeding the larvae gel. That's when you look at the brood pattern. You don't look at the cat pattern. Look at the larva pattern. Because if there's a problem, it'll eliminate the larva right away. So if you've got a nice patch of eggs, really nice full patch, and you stick it in there, and those larvae hatch, and there's no problem, you'll have a nice patch of larvae that's uniform with no misses. But if you've got inbreeding issues, they'll remove the larvae that first day.
So they're removing larvae and have cat.
Right. But it shows up later as this.
The visual is easier.
Which can be confused with some other things like hygiene or other issues.
The disease. Some kind of sequence or whatever.
Right.
So the second day, you're okay if there's something.
Yeah, I think so.
First day.
Yeah.
Fifth day.
Well, he means from hatching.
From hatching.
Yeah, the first larva, yeah. The first day of
brooding.
Yeah, you're right. The fourth or fifth day after the egg laid. So look at the larval pattern. That's the key. This is just a visual that's easy to see on a computer screen. But here's the point I was trying to make. It's not just sex alleles that get matched up. It's any allele. It's like Huntington's chorea. It's a rare gene. You know, it gets matched up. It's going to increase. Anytime you inbreed, it's not just sex alleles, it's other alleles that may be bad for bees. And it may affect them in the larval stage, it may affect them as adults. We don't know. It's just that we focus on the sex alleles because we can see it. Okay? So, I think that's it here. And the only point I want to make here is, when I was younger, we had mating yards that had 1,500 nukes in them. That's the guy I worked for. That's how many queens you raised. It's a lot of work, especially now that we have small hive beetles to deal with. Maintaining nukes is no fun. So bee breeding is a commitment. It's learning to select. It's keeping good records. But it's also spending a heck of a lot of time into producing and maintaining stock. And this is why I think it's good for people to work together. Somehow form groups of similar interests, similar stock, and somehow delegate the labor. As long as everybody's on the same page about how the mating is going to be done, find a way, because this is a lot of work to really breed bees. It's just a lot of beekeeping work. Yes, sir.
Get back to the bee breeding. What is the suggested number of the line to start with so that you pull up?
Most bee breeders will tell you you can't get enough. The hypothetical models that were generated in the 80s, they always said 300 to 500 colonies as your base pool.
from all kinds of places. Nobody can do that. Even Sue couldn't do that. I mean, so I think Sue at Ohio State, she could probably correct me. She probably was operating on the level of 150 to 200 colleagues and trying to do it at that level. I'm trying to do it at the level of 125 colleagues, but it gets to be, I mean, it gets to be unwieldy. But you're right. The most important thing, most breeding books suggest that your base population ought to be as genetically variable as possible, because as soon as you start selecting, you're going to narrow. Now, I think what Sue would say is, yeah, that's all good and all, theory's theory, but there's also a practical limit to what you can do. Can you really select 500 colleagues every year and pick the best 10%, 50 to be your queen? It's hard work, and most people can't do it. So what she would probably say is, she's been selecting New World Carniolans forever. Must be at the 30th year now. I don't really know. But what she realized is, what you can do is, if you do it carefully, and I'll talk a little bit about this later, is you can infuse new genetics periodically and realize that you're going to take a couple steps back when you do that, but at least you're probably upping the genetic variability of a line that you've been selecting for a while, or a stock.
So an example of that would be to bring in some more stock and use it as grown?
Yeah, now what she did was smart. She likes Carniola, so she went to Europe and found Carniola stock that wasn't related to hers, but it still has the Carniola traits that she likes, except for some of the pissiness. But so the idea was, I'm going to infuse my existing stock with something that's similar but not related to it, and I went to another place in the planet that has this, but it's not related to my stock. And she brought in semen, and she's been trickling it in and being careful not to overwhelm the system and blow 30 years of selection, and just tweaking it in.
And since we're making most of the box surprises, so you can go from any variety of Italian to
Well, I guess it depends on the qualities of the stock that you may have already have established. You know, it's my impression that a lot of the northern beekeepers like locally adapted stock that's kind of Carniola-like. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure you want to, admittedly, we don't have any pure Carniola or Italian in America. We have all mongrels, but still, there certainly is Italian stock out there that's very Italian-like, meaning they don't overwinter well, they brood up, they starve in the summer because they don't know when to shut down. And you may not want that in your bees in the Midwest. You may not want colonies that don't know when to stop brood rearing in the summer, when the dearth is on. So you've got to be careful. You've got to decide, and you may just have to try it too. So my feeling is, if you've already got a stock that's looking, even though it's a mongrel, more Carniola-like, you probably don't want to throw an Italian that's like,
so the danger there is going back to dozens of stuff.
Yeah, and then you're back to square one, or, you know. That's what you worry about. It may depend on how far along you are in the program. You know, how long have you been doing this? 15 years?
Well, the challenge that you're going to face also is, you know, you could have, you know, you've got your little 25, 30 hives in your apiary, but 5 miles away, you got someone that brought something on from another area. I mean, that's what the reality is, especially in the Chicago metropolitan market. You know, there's 12,000 packages that come into that market every year from all over the country.
And so, that's why the saturation technique may be what you have to do. And you may, in these days of Varroa, with the saturation technique, you can read about Larry Connor. He gets recommendations in various places about how to do this, like numbers of drones you should have. I would say whatever number of drones he says, multiply by 4. Make sure you have way more drones per queen than you ever would need. Just to hedge your bets, if you can. Because it's easy to raise drones anymore with the new drone combs and all. You can really crank out drones.
Is that the type of thing that they're using with the mechanics and the use of the family at
times? You know, I have no idea what they're doing there. I really haven't. My tech is going over to Texas next week, and I'll have her pry, but I really don't know what they're doing there. There's a group there doing some selection, what you're saying?
Well, as I understand it, there's hygienics down there, and they're
in Houston. Roofer. Well, there's that bad bees around them. That's what I can say. Well, I guess you'll know if the defense behavior slips, you know, what's going on. I guess we've
Yeah, and unfortunately, I didn't print out the agenda, so I have to look at the slide.
Well, I got a key question on the genetics that's basic to all this.
When, sure.
Say you have bees that are defensive.
Yeah.
You have a bee come at you. Is that a bee that has the genetics, or are you assuming that the whole hive has that genetics? I mean, given the fact that the queen mates with 20 drones, let's say, one out of 20 eggs is going to have that defensive behavior if you get stung. It's really that one bee, isn't it, that has that sensitivity?
It's colony-level behavior. So I'm not so concerned if one bee stings me.
Right.
What I'm concerned about is if I open colonies, and I'm used to opening colonies and not getting stung at all, or maybe one or two stings out of 50 colonies, but I go to a colony and I do the normal thing, my normal puffing the smoke at the entrance and lifting the lid, and as soon as I pop the lid, I get 30 stings in my hands. But
you also don't know if it's how much of the colony population is
right.
Field bees or guard bees that have actually come and checked
right.
you out.
That's the thing with all traits. And so there's two things about, you've got environmental effects and genetics effects. And you're right. Sometimes you just don't know. That's why I think with something like defense behavior, that can be highly variable even in the same colony through a year or even in the same week. It's always better to measure it multiple times and sort of use your average experience with that colony as a true reflection of its defense behavior and not just one incident.
Yeah, the fall.
But again, even all that said, it still may not be genetics. But that's all we got. I mean, what are you going to do? You know?
But